From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, entertaining, and if we can understand it, so can you. Our first guest this morning is Jeffrey Kluger, who co-wrote the book Apollo 13 with an astronaut from that mission, Jim Lovell. You all remember that movie? It's just fantastic. Anyway, Kluger now brings the same research and fascination about the space exploration back to a book called Apollo 8, the thrilling story of the first lunar mission.
And then, well, good morning, John.
Good morning, Lynn.
What if space exploration were available to the masses, even for, say, a vacation? Well, we'll be joined in the second half by an astronomer and a rocket scientist turned science writer who are part of the Intergalactic Travel Bureau. They've written a book called The Vacation Guide to the Solar System to show us how contemplating space travel is actually a good way to heighten and expand our curiosity about the cosmos.
These two guests plus today's cool stories when we return. You're listening to KPCW in Park City, Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest, Jeffrey Kluger, is the author of 8 previous books, including Apollo 13, which became the blockbuster movie. As a science editor and senior writer for Time magazine for more than 2 decades, he's written more than 40 cover stories for the magazine. In his new book, Apollo 8, he takes us back through the stories of NASA's first mission out of Earth's orbit to the moon in 1968. While it wasn't the famed space travel of Apollo 11 that resulted in man's first steps on the moon, Kluger tells how it's one of the most interesting because it was groundbreaking in more ways than just being a first. It was a time back in U.S. history. The country's morale was down, assassinations of some of our country's leaders, and a rush to beat Russia in space exploration that all played into this fascinating story. Jeffrey Kluger, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Hey, take us back to August of 1968. What was going on in the country? And NASA, known for very conservative flight schedules, they accelerated their first moon mission by 2 years to put Apollo 8 in lunar orbit just 4 months later. Tell us about what was going on in the country and at NASA.
Well, it was a terrible year for America. It was a terrible year for the world. In some ways, it was the most traumatic year in modern history. This was the year that, of course, the U.S. suffered the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, that so many cities were torn by riots. There were riots at the Democratic Convention. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam had begun that year. The Soviet Union had invaded Prague. There were riots in Mexico City, riots in Paris. The world was just coming unbuttoned. And things were no better at NASA. That had been the great shining hope of the U.S. for so long. But the year before, the Apollo 1 fire had occurred on a launch pad in Florida, killing astronauts Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. That basically brought the entire space program to a halt. The Apollo spacecraft had to be rebuilt. The lunar module that would take astronauts from lunar orbit down to the surface of the moon wasn't nearly ready. The Saturn V rocket was causing all kinds of headaches. And here we were, just a year and a third away from the end of the decade when President Kennedy had promised we would have human beings on the moon. It was at that rate going to take NASA at least 2 years, and maybe 3, to get people onto the lunar surface. And in that summer, a few very smart and very visionary people at NASA realized that if they fixed the machines properly, if they assigned the right people to the job, and if they caught a few lucky breaks, they could get three men into a spacecraft and into lunar orbit just 16 weeks later, in time to orbit by Christmas Eve, to kickstart the program and get men onto the surface of the moon sometime within the following year. And they did it. They took all the right chances. They did all the right, they made all of the right corrections in the hardware. They trained all the right people, and they got that spacecraft off the ground and the men into lunar orbit when they said they were going to.
Jeffrey, you call it an equal parts fearless and reckless mission. Ingenious and a wild crapshoot, on the other hand. If I were an astronaut, if I were Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, or Bill Anders, who you say signed on immediately, I don't know if I'd be there. What was it about these three men who said, yeah, we'll participate in this wild crapshoot?
Well, it's a very good question, and some of it speaks to the temperament of all astronauts. When I was, or for that matter, firefighters and police officers and combat military people, when I was writing Apollo 13 with Jim Lovell, I asked him, you know, did it ever occur to you before any of your flights when you were sitting in your living room looking around at your beautiful home in Houston that, you know, if this doesn't go right, I'm never going to see this room again? And Jim kind of laughed, and he said, no, if you thought that way, you wouldn't go. And I think that's what they all brought into it. Frank Borman, the commander of Apollo 8, was a military man. They were all military men, but Frank was just deeply patriotic. He signed on to the military to fight for his country, and when he didn't get a position in a hot war, he was in the Cold War, and he was going to fly to the moon and beat the Russians there. This would be his act of patriotic service. Lovell took a somewhat different approach. Lovell, as I always say, was never quite so happy as when he was in space, and never so happy in space as when he was doing something outrageously different. So for Lovell, Apollo 8 was a grand adventure. He was ecstatic to do it. And Anders was a man who loved machines. He remains that way. Anders loved the engineering. He loved the Apollo Command Module. He loved the Lunar Module. He loved knowing every rivet and line of code in those machines. So he was happy for the chance to take them out on a shakedown cruise and be part of this crew that went to the moon. They all knew they were also making history as the first people to go to the moon. But for them, these were jobs they were trained and they were innately equipped to do.
The Mercury program and the Gemini program were all within the Earth's atmosphere. So this is the first time that we have left the Earth's atmosphere in going to moon for the lunar orbit. And something that was unexpected, but at the same time, very scary. And that was, they thought that there might have been some radiation poisoning to Frank Borman, who became space sick for the first time. I mean, he had never been sick in an airplane before. So they were concerned that radiation may have played a part. And they considered, not the people in space, but back at NASA, they considered canceling this. Tell us about what happened during that part of the mission.
Yeah, that was something nobody had factored into their thinking. The Mercury and Gemini spacecraft were so tiny that the astronauts never got out of their seats. Well, if you don't get out of your seat, as we all know from feeling motion sick, you at least don't get that head-swimming feeling that makes things worse. In the Apollo spacecraft, they could get out and they could float around. So when Borman opened his seat restraints and got out, he immediately was overcome by this sense of motion sickness. The other astronauts were as well, but it wasn't quite as bad. But nobody expected that. So the fear was that in heading out of Earth orbit, remember, the planet is surrounded by the Van Allen radiation belts, a little bit like the breakers that surround an island and crash into the island. In order to get out to the moon, you have to cross those breakers. So the fear was that Borman had become poisoned by radiation, and if he was poisoned, the other two astronauts would probably be as well. Now, on the one hand, it was true that the Van Allen belts have only about as much radiation as a chest X-ray. On the other hand, it's a six-hour chest X-ray because that's how long it takes to get across the belts. So there was a real danger of this. As it turned out, it was not radiation poisoning. The other alternative was that it was a stomach virus. It wasn't that either. And within 12 hours or so, he began to feel better. But there was a call. The flight surgeon, the doctor, actually did say, it's my recommendation that we scrub this mission. But that was his job to make the conservative call, and he was overruled by the by people on the ground and by the astronauts themselves.
Wow. If you're just joining us, our guest is Jeffrey Kluger. He's written a new book called Apollo 8, The Thrilling Story of the First Mission to the Moon. Kluger is a longtime science editor and reporter for Time magazine. Jeffrey, you co-wrote the book on that became the movie on Apollo 13, along with Jim Lovell. And I'm just wondering, to contrast the two missions, this Apollo 8 book, it's a story that hasn't been told yet. Why hasn't it been told, and what attracted you to the story?
There were a lot of things that attracted me to the story. First, to reveal my age a bit, I was a 14-year-old boy at the time, and, you know, 14-year-old boys aren't given to a lot of sentimental emotion, but I was moved almost to tears by the magnificence of this mission and by the Genesis reading on Christmas Eve from lunar orbit. So I was touched by this as it was happening. I also felt that this is history that was untold and that deserved to be told. It was something like what attracted me to Apollo 13. You know, we all know the story of Apollo 11, the lunar landing. The first lunar landing. We all know the story of John Glenn orbiting the Earth, or becoming the first American to orbit the Earth, or Alan Shepard becoming the first American in space. But people didn't know about Apollo 13 quite as much because NASA considered it a failure, so they buried it. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know about Apollo 8 quite as well, or they did for about 7 months after it happened, but then it became eclipsed by the story of Apollo 11. In some respects, I always thought Apollo 8 was the larger, grander, more significant mission, and a lot of other astronauts and a lot of astrophysicists and historians do as well, because this represented the first time we peeled away from the gravity well of Earth, sailed across the true waters of deep space, and surrendered to the gravity field of another body. It was Apollo 8 that made us a species not of one world, but of two. And obviously, we in no way detract from the first lunar landing, but the Apollo 8 crew was the first to fly that quarter of a million miles to the moon. Mm. Apollo 11 did that too, and then they closed the last 60 miles. You know, that's no small thing.
Right.
But Apollo 8 got there first.
We just have a couple minutes left, but your research for this book was extraordinary, and your access to the people was I mean, you really looked at everything. And in addition to your boyhood wonder at 14, and I was exactly in the same camp as you, I very much enjoyed the first time they're on the dark side of the moon, and they rotate the capsule so that they have the windows facing the dark side of the moon. Nobody has ever seen this before. And it was their boyhood wonder that came out in your writing as they described what they saw. It was really cool, wasn't it?
It was. It was extraordinary. And that's what was amazing. Look, these guys were pilots. They weren't poets. And yet, they couldn't help but be moved by what they were seeing. They knew that in all of the history of Earth, since the moon was formed more than 4 billion years ago, it had always kept its far side turned away from Earth. Nobody had ever seen the far side of the moon before, and they were the first three people to see it. They were so dazzled by it that Bill Anders, who was the mission geologist and topographer, the man who knew the most about the lunar surface, he briefly lost all his lunar jargon. He looked down at the surface and saw the way the light was falling, and he said, "Boy, it's hard to tell the holes from the bumps." He meant to say the craters from the mounds, but he lost his language. They were so dazzled by it. So these three guys, you know, not given to lyricism, were moved to it nonetheless in their own way.
Jeffrey Kluger, Apollo 8, The Thrilling Story of the First Mission to the Moon. Jeffrey, we look forward to the movie.
Thank you so much. So do I. I'm hoping it happens.
Thanks for being Jeffrey. With us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, that was Jeffrey Kluger. And, you know, when did Apollo 13 come out? It was, it's had to be, what, 20 years ago? 15 years ago?
It was a Ron Howard movie, and it came out maybe 15 years ago. I don't remember exactly.
Right, but
when
if you saw
out.
The movie, you have never forgotten it. I mean, I'm one of those people that forgets all the movies, but I have never forgotten Apollo 13. So hopefully Apollo 8 will be made into a movie again. Oh, what a great book.
Yeah, we had never had a spacecraft that had broken like that, which is Apollo 13, and so far away from home outside of Earth's atmosphere. So it was a compelling movie, but as we talked about during our conversation with Jeffrey, there are a number of things that were first with Apollo 8 and breaking away from the mothership, from the Earth's atmosphere, that first rocket burn that they had that propelled them at 24,200 miles per hour towards the moon was pretty significant.
I feel like the dedication, as I had said to him, the dedication and the choice to serve our country in that way, back then, with a pretty good chance that you weren't going to come home, is really fascinating and beyond what I think I'm made up of, unfortunately, I'll admit it. But the excitement, actually, I just couldn't handle the motion sickness, frankly.
Oh, yeah. Well, these guys were test pilots back in the day, and they were Navy or they were Air Force test pilots, and they tried, I mean, they always had a lot of risk in their lives. But when Frank Borman took this assignment and he went and told his wife, his wife didn't ask him what the chances were. But when Gene Kranz came over to the house just to say hi for a barbecue, he's the guy in charge of flight operations, she cornered him and said, "Gene, I want it straight up. What are the chances?" And he said, 50-50.
Yeah. That's amazing. And weren't all of the wives directed to not tell the children, their children? It was, I had read that in the book, where it's just like, just don't mention that your dad is flying to the moon.
Right.
Or orbiting the moon, yeah.
Right. And the other thing is, one of the other astronauts, I think it was Anders, said that his son was not that impressed with what he did, but he couldn't stop talking about one of the neighbors whose father was a fireman.
Isn't that great?
It was a great time for us, huh?
Yeah, it really was. And just that the thought that morale of a country can also be very much attached to what we're doing in that regard, space exploration. And I think that there is a little resurgence about this, and I would credit it a lot to Margot Lee Shetterly's book, Hidden Figures, and then the resulting movie, you know, with the female, the group of women calculators.
Yeah.
What an inspiring story. And then a couple years ago, we interviewed on a book called The Astronauts Wives Club, which was a fascinating book.
It became a series.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's nice to hear these stories and to go back to a time that things were different, and yet we're still the same culture. We're still the same country, and embracing space exploration is it's a big deal, and it's a worthy endeavor.
I think that the next guest that we have on that has written this book about being a tourist and going and touring the solar system, I don't think that book would be successful at all 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago. But it's going to be successful now because people seem to be more curious about what's outside of the planet here. And it's sort of written tongue-in-cheek, and I think that they'll probably enjoy it. But there's something to be said about what's currently going on in astrophysics, where there are more breakthrough announcements on a very regular basis. It seems like you can't go by a week without somebody announcing something. So I think that there are a lot of people that are curious about this, and, well, that's kind of why we're doing Cool Science Radio.
That's right. That's right. Kind of bringing science to the masses and bringing them to even folks like us, lay people, in an interesting way. And speaking of some of the most interesting news stories that you see about space exploration, SpaceX, you know, we all love to hear what that character Elon Musk is up to, whether it's Tesla or his
Solar City
or SpaceX. We followed last year as they tried to return the capsules back to the launching platform out in the ocean. And they kept failing, and then finally they landed one back on the platform, which was for one of the purposes was to be able to think about recycling some of their capsules in the future. And so you have the cool story for today about what happened.
Well, going back to when they were trying that, they had one failure after another. And Jeff Bezos is from Amazon. His space company was actually the first one to have a successful re-landing of a booster. And certainly, if you can reuse a booster or if you can reuse a capsule, you're going to save some money. And that's the name of the game in the commercial enterprise of non-government sanctioned space companies like SpaceX. Well, anyway, they just launched their first recycled cargo ship, and that's what they call the Dragon capsule. And this was just a couple of days ago. They had a couple of day delay due to thunderstorms, and then the thing took off, and they used this capsule that was originally used 3 years ago. And then a couple of months ago, they launched its first recycled booster on a satellite resupply mission. And there's another one coming up with a reused booster later this month. So it's pretty cool.
So typically it's the booster that burns up. Isn't that correct?
It's typically the booster that falls into the ocean and just sinks and gets trashed.
Okay.
And this is what they're reusing. And their capsule that supplies, for an example, the International Space Station is now unmanned. They don't have to have astronauts like back in the shuttle days. That's the good news. It's unmanned. Mm-hmm. The not-so-good news has been that because there's no man on board, they can't land the thing back.
Right.
It's just one of those things. So now they're able to have it, you know, in an automated robotic way, have it re-enter the atmosphere and be able to reuse it.
Oh, that's great stuff. So let's take a quick break. We'll be back with our next guest. This, again, is a vacation guide to the solar system. And this is a great book, and we weren't sure what to think of it to begin with. But it really has to do with expanding your curiosity about the cosmos, about the solar system. And doing that through imagining if you were to go on vacation.
Yeah, and like remember in 2001, A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's film, where they had Pan America, I think it was, that had these vacations to the moon and beyond and all that sort of thing. And so it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, you learn a lot about there's 160 moons in our solar system, about some of these moons and our planets and things that you would see if you went there.
That's right. One of ours that we did an interview on just a couple of weeks ago, Europa, Jupiter's moons.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got to tell you, speaking of Europa, the sequel to 2001 was 2010, which was really cool. It was with Roy Schneider and some other guys. And I'm trying to think, well, anyway. And the conclusion of that, it was basically a follow-on to 2001, was that Jupiter lights up and becomes a star, and the star, it's a very intelligent star, mm-hmm. It sends this message back to the Earth and says that, you know, we're bringing you all this technology for your use, or this is for you and stuff like that. We ask one thing, do not go to Europa. Europa is ours.
That's great.
Whatever, whoever that was.
I love it. It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with John Wells. Well, it's not really science fiction. It's more about picturing yourself on a vacation to the moon or one of the planets. In a delightful way, the Vacation Guide to the Solar System tells us about what it's like out there among the planets and what it would be like to look back at Earth and consider our planet and how it may enhance really our perspectives about protecting this valuable and so far the only livable, inhabitable place that we know of and that we call home. Well, what would it be like to cruise through the rings of Saturn, or how about a submarine ride on Jupiter's moon Europa? That's, of course, after drilling through tens of kilometers of ice. Jana Gersovich and Olivia Kosky, in their delightful and beautifully illustrated book, Vacation Guide to the Solar System, take us there with facts, imagination, and the curiosity they present. This great book for anyone who wants to hone the development or really develop their interest in the solar system. Jana and Olivia, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Now, this is definitely Cool Science, Vacation Guide to the Solar System. I think that this is probably equal parts creativity, imagination, passion, and then also a metaphor for how we live on this Earth and how we should appreciate our life here on Earth, is it not?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you know, in writing this book, we explored all these different locations throughout the solar system, and there's lots of fascinating things to do and see. But I think, you know, while writing it, we really grew to appreciate just how rare and special our own Earth is. I mean, you don't need a spacesuit to walk around the surface, for example, which you definitely need on all the other planets if you can even survive on the surface at all. We had a really, really good time exploring the solar system.
So you kicked with this Intergalactic Travel Bureau, which if you Google that, you find yourself at this site called gorillascience.org. Some amazing, just beautiful illustrations about life in space. So talk about that and where this all, what the genesis was for this.
Yeah, so it all started with this live experience called the Intergalactic Travel Bureau, which is produced by Gorilla Science, a collective that brings together scientists and artists to spark conversations with the public about scientific topics. And so at the Intergalactic Travel Bureau, we invite people to come in, sit down, and plan their vacation to space with an astronomer. And then through the course of planning that vacation, they learn a lot about things going on out in space. And the Intergalactic Travel Bureau is something we've been doing the past 5 years. And that's how Jana and I met. Jana was an astronomer who volunteered to come help staff the Intergalactic Travel Bureau.
And it's also fascinating that as you look at your various locations, you bring out information that we would never know otherwise. For an example, before you see Jupiter, you will hear it on the radio. A few weeks from arrival, 3.5 million miles from landing, you will encounter the boundary of Jupiter's magnetosphere. And as you pass it, the radio will capture the sound of supersonic solar winds crashing in. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, Jupiter has a very, very strong magnetosphere and magnetic field, and it actually extends almost to the orbit of Saturn. So if you can think about how huge that is. And so all this magnetic activity means that Jupiter captures a lot of radiation from the sun, and it gets funneled in and creates some high radiation areas, which might create some problems for people who are visiting.
Another challenge for vacationers, and you know, I think about Elon Musk. He has a desire to die on the planet Mars one day. I mean, he's actually said that a number of times, and it's fascinating. We just did a interview, by the way, with the gentleman that wrote Apollo 8, which was the first lunar orbit, and he was talking about how Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Eric Anders talked about the extraordinary loneliness on the dark side of the moon. These vacation spots may not be as exciting. I mean, we really do have a good planet that we live on here, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, I mean, the moon, I think, is a nice place to go to if you want some solitude. You know, I think some people want to take a break from Earth, and spending some time on the far side of the moon would be quite appealing to some people, at least for a time. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of risks to space vacationing, a lot of adventure. But as you mentioned, you know, it's very lonely, and especially if you're traveling in a small space capsule for years or even decades, you know, I think that's something that would pose a challenge to many potential space vacationers.
Yeah, the loneliness can sometimes have advantages. So, for example, with the moon doesn't necessarily have a dark side and a light side. It has a near side, which faces the Earth always, and a far side, which doesn't face the Earth. And so people have talked about putting, for example, a radio telescope on the far side of the moon because it would be protected by the mass of the moon from all of the, basically the radio noise that we put off with all of our cell phones and gadgets and everything here on Earth. And so it could give us a clearer view of what's going on in the universe just by virtue of being isolated and far from the Earth, on the far side of the Earth, of the moon.
Janet, so you are an astronomer. Olivia, what's your background?
I studied physics in college, and I worked as an engineer at Lockheed Martin for a number of years before moving to New York and studying journalism at NYU. Master's in journalism. Yeah, made a little bit of a career switch, and then got involved with the Guerrilla Science Collective, which started in London and have helped bring it to the U.S. and bring, you know, things like the Intergalactic Travel Bureau to people in America.
So again, referencing this interview that we just had with Jeffrey Kluger, who wrote Apollo 8, and he also co-wrote Apollo 13, the book that the movie's based on. You know, we talk about people who are really passionate about space exploration, who followed all of the Apollo missions, for example, who are people like the two of you who are just fascinated by the thought of space exploration. And I'm wondering, what is the quality? Is it just general curiosity? You know, what is it that attracts you to space?
I think what attracts me to space is just how foreign and how alien it is. You know, to think about that there are places where you could, the atmosphere is so thick you could fly under your own power, for example, like on this Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, and these beautiful swirling clouds on Jupiter, just the sights that you could see is really what captures me.
And, you know, for me, I think it's just simply looking at the stars. I mean, I live in Brooklyn now and don't get a chance to see, you know, too many stars in the sky. But just the feeling of, you know, standing out in a forest and looking up at the sky and just seeing, you know, a black sky dotted with stars, just that emotional experience, I think, you know, has translated into like a passion and desire to know more, you know, to know more about what's out there. And that's what's really amazing to me about, you know, like a vacation to the moon, for example, that you could, you know, point to the moon, and some astronauts who've been there have this experience of saying, like, I've been there, and pointing to this thing in the sky. And that's just still blows my mind.
So let's talk about, how about Saturn? You know, I think Saturn sounds pretty good. It's a little longer than the sort of flight. I mean, I just got back from Boston, and that seemed like a really long flight. How long is it going to take me to get to Saturn?
Well, you're probably going to want to budget getting there and back at least a decade. And so when we talk about times to get there, you know, it's a really interesting scientific question too, right? Because if you were actually sending humans there, you would probably take a different route than the probes that have visited these planets. But we base our travel times on the probes that have gone and visited. So, for example, Cassini visiting Saturn.
Yeah, and speaking of Cassini, I mean, those pictures are remarkable. It's diving between the rings and the main body, and I want to go there right now. I mean, it's just phenomenal. If we were, from a distance looking at the Saturn rings, what would they look like as we approach and get closer?
Yeah, so when you get very close to the rings, you'll notice that it's not a solid body. It's a bunch of small ice and dust particles. So you might see it shimmer as it's reflecting light, but it's going to kind of break up into small pebble-sized to house-sized chunks of ice, basically. And fascinating about the rings is, and you can just spend days looking at the Cassini images of these, but there are moons that orbit within the gaps of the rings, and also the gravity from either from the rings itself or from these moons can create these beautiful rippling patterns in the rings. And so they're really, you know, they're not this static, solid thing. They're this dynamic group of little moonlets that are just orbiting around and around.
People may look back on this time that we live in right now and say this was the great renaissance in astrophysics. It seems like every week there are these breaking stories of research and new ideas. It's just very exciting. And maybe with some of the challenges we have back on the blue planet, people are looking more into the stars and thinking about things. I mean, I think the timing for your book is pretty good.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing to think about 100 years ago, you know, like the amount of things that we've learned in the past 100 years, the places that we've gone. I mean, airplanes were just barely taking off 100 years ago. Now, you know, we have rockets that are starting to be reused. Elon Musk is, you know, regularly sending rockets to the International Space Station. I mean, in 100 years from now, who knows what will be happening in terms of space travel?
Hmm.
Yeah, talk a little illustrations in this book, because I wish our listeners could see it. It is beautifully illustrated. Steve Thomas, did he do all of the illustrations in the book?
Yeah, so we work with this fantastic artist. His name's Steve Thomas. He's based out of Minnesota. And he does these beautiful retro future posters. And he was actually doing space travel posters before we contacted him. So he has a long history of these. And it was such a fun process working with him, not only because he's so talented, but because he's so patient with trying to get the details right in terms of these views that we created for the different planets. So for each chapter, we have this retro future space travel poster, a full page in color that shows all of these, like a view, basically what you might see if you visited this place. So we have someone meditating over the hexagon on Saturn. We have people kissing in orbit near Pluto. So we have a lot of kind of interesting angles on these different worlds.
If you are into space at all, you must have one of these. And my buddy here, John, has a couple of these posters hanging in his house.
I have three of these posters. And and one of them, of course, is the couple sort of in a romantic lean as they lean into each other as they watch a rocket take off from Mars. And I've got something in Pluto, and I've got, I think, skiing the beautiful snows of Titan. And the posters are beautiful.
Yeah, it really helps you imagine yourself on these distant worlds. I mean, the art was a really important part of the book and also the live experience that we do, because we have these posters on the wall in our Intergalactic Travel Bureau when people visit, and they look up at them and they see these whimsical depictions of vacations on other worlds. And I think, you know, it really helps people sort of see themselves visiting another planet.
Yeah.
What do you pack, Lynn, when you go to Uranus or to Titan? Maybe Olivia and Jenna, you can help us with that. What do you pack, and what sort of pre-flight stuff do we need to know and do?
The short answer is pack light, because to get up the speed to escape Earth's gravity takes a lot of energy, and so every extra pound is extremely expensive. It's like the worst baggage fees you could possibly imagine.
First bag is not free, huh?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the importance of things like Velcro, you know, in microgravity environments where, you know, things are flying around all the time. Duct tape, of course, is sort of a fix-all thing. You're going to want to bring a first aid kit because accidents can happen, and you might have to perform some minor surgery on yourself.
And the main thing you'll need to pack is all of the air and water that you will require. And, of course, the tools to keep you alive, because that's no simple matter.
So, all joking aside, where are we now on lunar travel, for example, to our moon? I know that that's that. I mean, can the average person who happens to have a large, a swollen bank account that trip?
Yeah, there are a couple of companies that have sold or have claimed to have sold trips to the moon. And this is something that's really fascinating for us because just in the 5 years that we've been planning space vacations, we've seen that landscape evolve really quickly. So, you know, people have sold trips to the moon. There are trips that are being sold to the edge of space, these suborbital flights. And, you know, hasn't been any private citizen trips to the moon yet, but there have been private citizens who have visited orbit to the International Space Station. So about 7 or 8 people have paid $30, $40, $50 million to visit the International Space Station. So it's only a matter of time before a private citizen is going to go to the moon. And what they'll probably do is a flyby of the moon because, you know, it's much easier to just go to the moon and orbit it once and come back than land. And that's something I think we learned from our research is, you know, flying by a planet isn't that much of a challenge. A lot of probes have done it. But, you know, if you want to stay for a while, that gets a lot more complicated, a lot more expensive. So I think, you know, we'll probably have flybys to the moon and then, you know, flybys of Mars after that.
Okay, Olivia and Jana, you can go anywhere you want in the solar system, anywhere, and travel, and time's not a consideration. Where would you like to go and why?
I think I would like to go and see the hexagon on the pole of Saturn. So Saturn is this gas world, and there's this huge hexagon at one of the poles. And this is surprising to everyone when it was first seen. Each one of the sides of the hexagon is bigger than the Earth. And it's kind of like a vortex in the clouds, just created by the different layers of clouds that are rotating. And so I would go and I would, like is depicted in the picture, I want to meditate over the hexagon and have a nice relaxing time around Saturn.
Oh, so and civilized.
I would definitely go to Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. It's an ice moon. It's completely covered in ice, you know, miles, if not tens of miles thick. And they think that there's an ocean, a liquid ocean beneath that layer. So I would love to go to Europa, stand on the surface, and look at a view of Jupiter, which is going to be huge in the sky and just beautiful with its swirling gases. And then I would drill down into the ice and take a submarine tour of the ocean.
I think I'm with you. That sounds great. Well, Olivia Koski and Jana Gersovich have written a new book called Vacation, Guide to the Solar System. It's by that intergalactic travel bureau that they belong to. It's science for the savvy space traveler. And we're so glad you could join us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And that was great. Hey, you didn't say where you would want to go.
Well, I wouldn't mind going to the far side of the moon and cruising around and coming back in a couple of weeks, but I don't want to go away for 10 years. and I, you know, Elon Musk has said several times now in public that his mission is to die on the planet Mars, and I don't want to do that, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, I like all this stuff, and I'm very curious, but geez, I don't know about leaving planet Earth here.
Right. And, you know, again, when you go away, you know, sometimes when you leave this country and you go to places, you go, Well, I'm really glad I, you know, was born in this country and that I continue to live here. I feel that way every time I leave Park City, for sure. And I go on some wonderful vacation, and it's wonderful, and I love it. But when you drive back into Park City, you go, you know, this is a good place to come home to.
Exactly.
And it's the same on our planet Earth. You know, at the end of the day, this is where we want to be.
Yeah, it's a good place to be. We can probably do a little better job of taking care of her, but
exactly.
And maybe we will.
That's right. Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back.
Sounds good.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. And, you know, I got the latest, greatest iPhone.
Yeah.
Right? And I just did the update, which was, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. I haven't seen anything. You know, every time you update, something disastrous seems to happen. That didn't happen to me. But there is going to be another update. The 11 update is going to...
iOS 11.
Yeah, it's going to be rolled out this fall to iPhones and iPads. It's going to have a new feature, and that is Apple's version of Venmo. Mm-hmm. So peer-to-peer paying, money transferring system that's kind of new for Apple. It's called Apple Pay.
Yeah, it's going to be part of Apple Pay, which is something they announced before, but it's going to be a lot easier to use.
That's right. Easier to use than, say, Venmo. Is that what you're saying?
Well, easier to use than Apple Pay was before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find this interesting. We were talking before, and you said that you don't use Venmo, you don't use Apple Pay.
No, currently. Not currently, but I'd like to evaluate the different options out there because I think it does make sense for moving money around.
Yeah, and I know people in our peer group that pay for everything on Apple Pay. They go to the grocery store, right. They pay that, they pay, you know. And we were talking about how young people these days, if they're splitting up utilities, if they all rent an apartment together, for example, they all do it on Venmo or Apple Pay.
Sure.
And it's a generational thing. We're kind of starting to bridge the gap a little bit. I've used Venmo a total of one time.
Ah.
We were all going together to get some flowers for our friend who had surgery, and the person organizing it forced us all to sign up for Venmo, and it was so easy.
Yeah,
it was so easy. But I will say I have these great kids that are tenants of mine, and when they pay rent, the first time, we didn't know exactly how we were going to do it, but I said, well, do you write checks? Not even knowing if people under 30 even have checks. And they said, oh, yeah. And when I got a check, they put their name, their signature in the wrong place.
Whoa.
And so what I knew, I mean, it was so sweet and cute and a signal to me that these kids, if you're under 30, you don't write checks.
Right.
You know, my kids don't. Do your kids have, do they even have
no,
checks?
No, they do everything off their iPhones.
Yeah.
And it's great. So a couple of things to distinguish the iOS 11 update, which is coming out. One is when they enhance Apple Pay so that you can go peer-to-peer, and again, that will be this fall, you can only do it in a homogeneous Apple-to-Apple type situation versus Venmo crosses all the different platforms. So that's one distinguishing thing. Another distinguishing thing is that Venmo charges 3% for using your credit card and also makes money off the merchant fees. Square Cash makes money off the merchant's fees, makes you pay 1%. Apple Pay will be at no cost. However, you have to pay someone something to authorize.net to set up. That's the vehicle that actually does the banking transaction.
Right, so it's just an initial fee.
It's just an initial fee. I'm not exactly sure what it was. But this whole hoopla about this Apple announcement was really driven by HomePod, which was their answer to Amazon's Dot Echo and Echo Show and Google's Home, which is having you know, Alexa or, mm-hmm. you know, having a personal assistant that can play music for you and do other things. And so it's expensive. It's $350 versus Google Home, which is $129. And the three Amazon products, the least expensive is the Dot for $50. So as usual, Apple's more expensive. And then the other thing is, if you already have an investment in something like Sonos, where you have speakers throughout the house that are playing your music, you can use a Dot for $50 because I think they have the interface now to Sonos, and it's probably more cost effective than going with the Apple solution. But Apple may offer enhancements and make it better. But Apple has a tendency of announcing products, and regardless of what the price point is, the Apple fans will go out and pay it.
Mm. You have a pretty new house. How automated is it? How do you talk to Alexa in your house when you're alone?
No, I was waiting for the interface to Sonos, which is out. So I'm going to get probably one of the get an Amazon Dot for $50 in my family room, and then for $50 in my bedroom, and be able to, through voice commands, be able to get music up, and also be able to, because I have really good speakers in the walls and everything, be able to, you know, query the net, the worldwide net, whatever we call it these days.
Excellent. Okay. Hey, we want to thank our guest today, Jeffrey Kluger. He wrote the new book called Apollo 8, the thrilling story of the first mission to the moon. It's maybe the untold story. It is the untold story until now. A great book. And then also... our guests, Olivia Koski and Jana, Gersovich, and their beautifully illustrated book, Vacation Guide to the Solar System. And also thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Hey, we have just about a minute left. Did you read the story? I saw it in the New York Times yesterday, but it was reported in a science journal. The oldest fossil ever found of Homo sapiens.
A human fossil.
Human fossil, and it is a jaw that is... Well, it's intact now. I don't know how many pieces it was when they found it in the site. But prior to finding this human mandible discovered in Morocco, and this is 300,000 years old.
It's been dated.
Yeah. Prior to that, 195,000 years old was the oldest human fossil that had been
found
in Ethiopia.
Ethiopia.
Okay. Yeah. And so a great discovery. The oldest known remains of Homo sapiens. I thought that was a great, really great story.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating.
And as we were talking about, but don't have time to go into, the difference between like where the departure was when the ape fell out of the tree or stayed in the tree. We should explore that.
I'm still having trouble with that.
Let's get these guys on as our guests.
Yeah.
Who reported, and I think it was the Journal of Science.
Okay.
Yeah. Nature Science. There we go. You're listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington. Thanks for tuning in today.